Hello and welcome to Managing AML. My name is Dr. Eunice Wang and today I will be discussing novel treatment options in secondary AML. Here are the learning objectives of this talk. Number one, I will be differentiating and defining the two distinct subtypes of AML that will be followed by a discussion of a comprehensive initial diagnostic testing algorithm, which has been supported by national organizations and all patients diagnosed with AML. Following that, I'm going to discuss disease prognostication as well as development of specific treatment plans for secondary AML based on the incorporation of novel treatment options developed over the last 3 years. And lastly, I'd like to discuss how to incorporate this upcoming data into treatment algorithms personalized for individual patients. Now, shown here is what we would call the ideal diagnostic workup for a patient suspected to have acute myeloid leukemia, or AML, in 2021. As you can see here, the cornerstone of diagnosis of AML remains hematopathology or morphology, and review of the peripheral smear or bone marrow aspirate to determine whether a patient has AML remains the first step in making this diagnosis. However, we have many other tools in our toolkit in this day and era. For example, on the same day that we can get morphology or hematopathology review at our center, we have the ability to obtain rapid results of flow cytometric analysis for multiple antigens demonstrating whether the leukemia is of the myeloid or lymphoid lineage. This is followed usually a day or two later, business days, by a preliminary conventional cytogenetics where we're looking at the 21 chromosomes and detecting whether there are any diagnostic translocations, monosomy, deletions, etc. And these can also be confirmed by rapid fluorescent in situ hybridization that takes about 4 to 6 hours. What takes a longer period of time is mutational evaluation. We do two types of mutational profiling on patients with AML. Number one, we do targeted specific gene mutation PCR for either FLT3, FLT3 mutations, or IDH1, IDH2 mutations. And that is because of the presence and availability of targeted mutation-specific therapies for these specific genes. Typically, though, there are many, many other genes that can contribute to prognostication, and for that analysis, we require a broader myeloid panel, which can take up to 10 to 17 business days and can encompass anywhere from 75 to 100 to even 400 or 500 different gene mutations. Now, what are the prognostic factors that we look for specifically in patients with AML? Well, we know that there are some what we call traditional or conventional clinical features that are very highly prognostic for this disease. You can see these involve simple calculations or simple clinical parameters such as age, comorbidities, performance status, organ function, do they have an elevated creatinine or a decreased ejection fraction. We also look at evidence of tumor burden. So obviously patients who have high LDH levels reflecting high disease burden or high or rising white blood cell count would be at higher risk. And nowadays, in the newer era, we are more and more looking at not only mutational profiling and cytogenetics, which are essential for the diagnosis of AML, but also new prognostic markers, including minimal residual or measurable residual disease markers by flow cytometry or molecular analysis. Now, you can see here that the current most widely accepted classification for acute myeloid leukemia involves a combination of cytogenetic and mutational information. There are favorable, intermediate, and adverse karyotype. And I'd like to highlight here in red those lesions which are pathognomonic of what we call a secondary AML or an AML which has arisen from an antecedent hematologic condition or from prior chemotherapy or radiation therapy. Patients that have these specific cytogenetic features, specifically aberrations in chromosome 5 or 7, monosomy karyotype or complex karyotype with 3 or more abnormalities, are those that are diagnostic for having secondary AML. what is our definition of secondary AML? Well, as I just mentioned, it is an AML process which is evolved from a prior hematologic condition, and these encompass prior MDS, myeloproliferative neoplasm, or aplastic anemia with or without treatment. The second category of secondary AML involves the development of AML following a prior therapy involving radiation or chemotherapy for a prior cancer or any prior condition, for example, autoimmune disease. As you can see here, here is a diagram showing how secondary AML originates. You can see here that there are damaged hematopoietic stem cells, either normal healthy cells which have been exposed to radiation or chemotherapy, or cells which are aberrant because of underlying mutations or genetic events that have led to the development of myeloproliferative disorder, myelodysplastic syndrome, or bone marrow failure syndromes. These damaged clones over time will undergo different types of clonal evolution. As you can see on the top, there's linear evolution where it just grows out numerically, or you can have what we call branching evolution where the cells just don't grow, but they actually evolve into secondary subclones, and those subclones further divide into other subclones. Either one of these processes can lead at the end product here on the right-hand side to what we would call secondary acute myeloid leukemia. Now, are there any mutations that are specific for secondary AML? We talked a little bit about the cytogenetic abnormalities, but emerging data piloted by Dr. Coleman Lindsley at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has demonstrated that specific mutations identified in AML cells can be pathognomonic for one of these secondary AML evolution processes. So as you can see here, the presence of what we call spliceosome mutations in SFRSF2, SF3B1, UTAF1, and others can be specifically linked to a secondary AML origin. And you can see here some of the other mutations which are linked to these. The presence of any of these clinical histories, cytogenetics, or potentially mutational events suspicious for secondary AML can lead one to this diagnosis in this day and era. Now, why is it important that we have a diagnosis of secondary AML? Well, I'm going to walk you through some of the treatment modalities which can be specifically applied for this subtype of AML. It is important prognostically as also therapeutically to make the correct diagnosis. So just to review, AML with myelodysplastic related changes, or AML with AML-MRC as we call it, is defined as one of the subtypes of secondary AML. This is AML associated with either a known proven history of MDS or with AML diagnosed in the presence of specific MDS-related cytogenetic findings, as we mentioned previously. All AML cases need to have more than 20% blasts in the marrow, and in many of these cases, we can find some of those mutations which are not pathognomonic and not listed right now in the classification, but highly suggestive of a secondary AML abnormality. So here you can see here some of these cytogenetic changes. The second major category of secondary AML is therapy-related AML, is defined TAML in brief. And the World Health Organization has defined therapy-related AML as arising from prior cytotoxic therapy or ionizing radiotherapy for an unrelated disease. As you can see here on the left-hand side, over half of patients with therapy-related AML will have a diagnosis of a prior solid tumor leading to this therapy. However, you can see that up to 49% of patients will have a prior condition that may not be a solid tumor. About a third of these patients will have a prior lymphoproliferative disorder for which they may have received DNA damaging agents or agents such as Revlimid for multiple myeloma. And a smaller fraction of patients are going to have other conditions, including autoimmune diseases for which they've received cytotoxic therapy. Shown here on the right-hand side are some of the typical cytogenetic abnormalities which have traditionally been identified in patients with therapy-related AML. However, in the presence of some of these other findings, the diagnosis of therapy-related MDS may not necessarily be made purely based on cytogenetic and molecular features. Now, as we mentioned previously, and as you can see, based on the presence of some of these what we call unfavorable cytogenetic and mutational events, secondary AML is associated with a worse prognosis than de novo AML. Shown here on the left-hand side are the outcomes of secondary AML as compared to de novo AML in similar age range patients. And you can see a significant drop-off in expected response rates and overall survival in these patients. You can see also on the right-hand side that even in the absence of, say, one would say a clinical history of a prior antecedent MDS, the presence even of these secondary mutations suggestive of a secondary AML can also be associated with worse prognosis independent of a clear clinical history. Now, how would one cure patients with secondary AML? Well, patients with secondary AML have worse outcomes, and their outcomes are markedly improved if one is able to offer allogeneic stem cell transplantation. As you can see here, for both younger and for older patients, the ability to offer a curative hematopoietic stem cell transplantation remains the only and best way to achieve long-term survival for these patients. Now, what is the upfront therapy in order to offer some type of allogeneic stem cell transplantation? Majority of these patients have to have upfront therapy after their diagnosis. So I would recommend after the diagnosis of secondary AML that one explore these specific targeted therapies which are designed to best improve the outcomes of these individuals both in the absence and the presence of subsequent allogeneic stem cell transplantation. The first therapy that I will discuss was liposomal 7+3, previously known as CPX351. What is CPX351? It is a specific liposomal formulation of two drugs, cytarabine and daunorubicin, which represent the standard 7+3 intensive chemotherapy regimen for patients with de novo AML. However, individuals with secondary AML, as we showed you, have a worse prognosis with standard 7+3, leading to the theory that if one could improve the delivery and the pharmacokinetics of 7+3, could one improve outcomes for this poor prognosis subset? And you can see here that CPX351 was rationally designed specifically for that purpose. In the laboratory, combinations of cytarabine and daunorubicin were tested in different molar ratios with the identification of a fixed 5.1 molar ratio as being the most effective in eliminating AML cells. In a randomized phase 3 trial of individuals 60 to 75 and above who were fit enough to receive intensive chemotherapy based on performance status and who had intermediate or poor cytogenetic or molecular risk classifications of secondary AML, patients who received the liposomal cytarabine daunorubicin had markedly and significantly improved overall survival as compared to those receiving 7+3 alone. You can also see, as we talked about, that many of these patients will experience the greatest benefit to therapy if they are able to achieve a complete remission and proceed on to subsequent allogeneic stem cell transplantation. The results on the right-hand side highlight the benefit of upfront liposomal cytarabine daunorubicin, particularly in those subset of patients who are able to get to allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Patients receiving CPX not only had higher rates of remission, but also because they had higher rates of remission, were more able to go to an allogeneic stem cell transplantation than patients receiving 7+3. When you look at the subset analysis of patients treated on this trial, you can see here that patients both with therapy-related as well as AML-MRC all benefited from the application and use of cytarabine in a liposomal formulation as compared to standard 7+3. Now, what were the adverse events that we're seeing with CPX351? Well, as we know, because this is a different formulation of 7+3, it is associated with very many of the exact same same adverse events as we see with standard 7+3. As you can see here, the incidences of febrile neutropenia, pneumonia, fatigue, nausea and vomiting, everything was eerily identical to what we see with 7+3. The only difference between patients receiving the liposomal versus the standard 7+3 was the number of patients who were dying from leukemia-related complications. That incidence was actually markedly higher in patients receiving standard therapy than those receiving the newer formulation, because the newer formulation was more efficacious in controlling their disease. You can see here on the right-hand side that one of the things we did see was, given the improved drug delivery to the bone marrow microenvironment, that patients receiving liposomal compound had delayed recovery of blood counts, particularly neutrophils and specifically platelets. The delayed time to platelet recovery was associated with a statistically significant slighter increase in fatal or life-threatening hemorrhage in those individuals. When we look across the board, though, we can see that many of these individuals that had specific mutations did specifically benefit from the use of CPX351. You can see patients with AML associated with mutations in AXL1, DMNT3A, RUNX1, and TET2 all had a statistically significant improvement in overall survival. However, there was one group of patients, those with TP53 mutant AML in the secondary setting, who did not appear to derive the same benefit from CPX as other patients. Now, recently, we have looked at the 5-year long-term outcomes of patients enrolled on this trial. And this is a little bit skewed because many of the patients on this trial were treated, were older patients, all age 60 and above. But you can see here at long-term 5-year follow-up, the survival advantage that patients see with CPX is maintained, and that there are about 20-30% of individuals who are long-term survivors of secondary AML as a result of using this formulation, which is a new thing, because typically we would have said that those patients would not have survived this long. You can see, again, the benefit of CPX351 is also maintained or even magnified in the presence of allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Now, many of our patients, particularly those diagnosed with secondary AML, are not necessarily going to be able to receive intensive chemotherapy because of their comorbidities, because of their performance status, and just because of patient decision making. A lot of these individuals are not going to be particularly amenable to being admitted and receiving intensive myelosuppressive therapy for 4, 5, or even 6 weeks, with a potentially even longer duration of cytopenias seen with the liposomal formulation. So for these individuals, who represent a very large section of our older patient population, the standard of care therapy now is been demonstrated to constitute treatment with venetoclax and a low-dose hypomethylating agent, specifically azacitidine. Now, the combination of venetoclax plus azacitidine or decitabine requires some additional information, because it's not as easy as adding 1+2. When one adds the oral BCL-2 inhibitor to epigenetic therapy, we see significantly different adverse events as well as management strategies. For one thing, there is an increased risk of tumor lysis syndrome in patients initiating therapy with this combination. So patients typically are admitted for the first week or so of therapy with close monitoring for tumor lysis. Shown here is the schema that we typically would recommend for dose escalation of the oral BCL-2 inhibitor in combination with hypomethylating agents. This particular dual treatment with the BCL-2 inhibitor venetoclax and azacitidine has dramatically improved overall response rates for older individuals with newly diagnosed AML. By older, the typical definition was 75 years of age or above, or those with significant comorbidities, i.e. Decreases or compromise in their cardiac, pulmonary, or renal function, which would render them at high risk to receive an intensive chemotherapy regimen. Shown here, we can see the marked improvement in the overall response rate when we use combination of venetoclax azacitidine as compared to a cohort of patients randomized to azacitidine alone. 67% overall response rate represent an almost doubling of overall response with the combination treatment as compared to placebo and azacitidine alone. This combination also led to a statistically significant improvement in overall survival with a median overall survival of 14.7 months as opposed to 9 months in the azacitidine treatment alone. We also know that in certain of these individuals, their performance status and their comorbidities can be affected by the presence of AML at the time of diagnosis. So there are a proportion of patients who may not be considered fit for intensive chemotherapy, but following chemotherapy with azacitidine and venetoclax can achieve an improved performance status or improvement in their overall functionality that would permit them to receive subsequent allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Early data presented in 2019 has demonstrated that up to 5 to 10% of individuals can also still proceed to an allogeneic stem cell transplantation following venetoclax azacitidine therapy. Are there differences by mutational subtypes in which patients are going to respond? There are. Once again, here you can see that when we look at dividing up these secondary AML patients by cytogenetic risk or by secondary versus de novo disease, that there really is a benefit seen across the board with about 2/3 of patients responding. However, of note, in this particular trial, patients with prior myeloproliferative disease were excluded. What about patients who have received prior hypomethylating agents? For those patients, treating them again with venetoclax azacitidine is not typically recommended. And there is a second regimen combining venetoclax with low-dose cytarabine, which can be utilized in these individuals who've had significant prior hypomethylating agents with some clinical benefit as well. Looking across the board, however, when we examine the responses of patients receiving either venetoclax azacitidine or venetoclax low-dose cytarabine, we see, again, a distressing low response rate in patients with P53 mutant AML, as evidenced by very short disease-free intervals and no significant improvement in overall survival in that subgroup. We also see that patients that have FLT3 mutant disease tend to go into remission, but again, to not have potentially the same overall survival that we see in other subgroups of patients. So for these individual patients with secondary AML, it may be of utility to think about investigational therapies. And I'm not going to go into great detail, but just showing you here two novel experimental therapies for P53 mutant AML in particular that may be of consideration for individuals that have secondary AML characterized by this particularly grim prognosis mutation. Shown here on the left is a small molecule inhibitor, a reactivator of mutant P53 AML, APR246. Shown on the right-hand side is the novel magrolimab antibody, an anti-CD47 antibody. Both of these agents in combination with azacitidine have resulted in response rates in P53 mutant patients ranging in the 60-70% range. And both are under active investigation for targeted therapy of this particular poor group of patients. So in summary, how do we diagnose patients? How do we prognosticate patients? How do we select therapy for patients? So many of these topics we've already reviewed, and this is just a summary treatment algorithm for my recommendations for how to manage patients with secondary AML. Of course, there needs to be an initial assessment of both the patient characteristics and the AML disease characteristics, and that should include fitness, age, performance status, cytogenetics, molecular features, as well as additional immunophenotyping and other analyses. We see here that fit individuals who have secondary AML who are potentially eligible for allogeneic transplantation in particular should be offered therapy with liposomal cytarabine daunorubicin. In contrast, unfit individuals should be offered upfront therapy with venetoclax azacitidine, and those who have particularly poor karyotype or p53 mutant disease should be considered for upfront clinical trial enrollment. The goal for many of our patients is going to be allogeneic stem cell transplantation. For those that are unable to proceed, then we would continue onward with the variation of their upfront therapy. So thank you very much for taking the time to view this activity. I hope you found it useful and applicable for your management of patients with secondary AML.